Psycho Man. Hello, boys and girls, and welcome to the Motorcycle Men Podcast. This is Ted, your host, and this is episode 459. And we're here in the V-Twin Cafe, as always. And today, rolling into today's episode, we've got something a little special lined up. Now, if you've spent any time wandering the back roads of YouTube or diving into the world of garage-built moto culture, you've probably stumbled across the Tall Boys and Trackmasters Podcast. James and Trevor, two riders who mix storytelling, dual sport adventures, and a healthy dose of, did we really just say that, energy in every episode they do. So these guys have carved out their own corner of the motorcycle universe, blending long-form conversations with the kind of humor you only get from people who've logged real miles and made real mistakes. They talk bikes, mods, beer, bad decisions, and riders who make this whole dual sport community worth being part of. So today we're pulling them into our world to talk about their show, how it came to be, what keeps them fired up, and how they're using YouTube to bring even more riders into the fold. So grab a coffee, crack a tall boy, depending upon the time of day, of course, and settle in. This is the Motorcycle Men Podcast, and we're hanging out with tall boys and track masters today. Let's get into it. All right, and we're back, and joining me right now, all the way from, you guys are where?
West Virginia.
Both of you are in West Virginia.
Yes.
Yep.
Oh, okay.
So James is based out of Fairmont. I'm based out of Masontown.
Okay.
Yeah, we're about 25 miles apart, give or take. Oh,
really? Okay. Yeah. That's not too bad, though. And, these guys are from the Tall Boys and Trackmasters Podcast. And they're here to tell us all about it. We're here in the V-Twin Cafe. This is Motorcycle Man Podcast, episode 459. So, all right, guys, how you doing?
Cold, buddy. Cold.
Cold, yeah.
That seems to be the main complaint these days. It's just cold. Yep. That's cold. So there's no... Are your roads clear where you are?
It's taken, what, probably 2.5 weeks or so to get them somewhat clear. I know Trevor, Preston County's still pretty crappy up that way.
Yeah, it got so bad in my county that they had to contract an excavating company to start clearing snow. The state road, I guess, couldn't keep up with it. So,
oh, wow. So yeah. You guys you're off the bikes for a while.
Yeah. I don't know. This thing was before Christmas. I took my KTM for some laps around the yard. We had like 13
laps
inches
around the yard.
Yeah, we had 13 inches of powder, and it was great. I wish I had studs or a snow bike kit.
I tell you what, I got a loaner trials bike in my garage right now from our good friend Mr. Tom King, and I had it out in the yard in about 10 inches of snow ripping around. So you would be surprised at how well a set of trials tires will hook up in the ice and snow. I was surprised about that.
Yeah, especially with the Sipes on them. See, I was running a Shinko 216 MX up front and Trackmaster out back that's pretty wore down from Red River. And that bike would go anywhere but where I pointed it.
Wow. So you guys must have some property that you can do that kind of thing.
I have like close to an acre.
All right, that's good.
So it's like run around the front of the house or on the back.
I'm
the house.
I'm in downtown Fairmont, so yeah, it's just around my yard, and all of the friendly city of Fairmont can see me ride around and rip around right there. And I'm sure the people in the Pizza Hut across the street right there got a heck of a show when I was hopping around on the trials. Yeah.
Your neighbors must love you guys.
Well, listen, I was always told that if you do not have the obnoxious neighbor that has all of the loud stuff, then it's you. That's definitely me and my neighbor.
Okay.
Yeah.
So why don't you guys tell us who you are, your motorcycle self, and what you do? You guys pick
James,
up first. I'll
James, ones. You go first.
Okay. I'm James Wright, born and raised here in the Mountain State here in West Virginia. Just always had a unhealthy obsession with motorcycles from a young age. My dad was, yes. Well, I call it healthy, I guess. My wife would probably say it's unhealthy, but No, that was kind of ingrained in me at a young age. My dad was the same way, always liked anything mechanical, anything with wheels, and was going to cost you lots of money to maintain in the hobby. That was definitely my MO. You know, did a lot of off-road racing from the time I was 7 up until I was about 30, kind of got out of it, you know, the wife, the kids, the job, that sort of thing kind of transitions you out of that, and got into this, you know, dual sport and adventure motorcycle scene and really took to it like a duck to water. And,
yeah,
you know, my favorite part about it was a lot of the guys that I used to race and ride with have also transitioned into this. So, you know, a lot of familiar faces, and being able to go anywhere and ride anything at any point you want is really appealing to me, as compared to doing the racing scene where you race for, you know, 2 to 3 hours and you have a set course and, mm-hmm. you know, you're kind of limited in that respect. But yeah, started that, and you know, eventually met the guy over here that's with us today, Mr. Schoonover. And, you know, me and him really kind of hit it off from the get-go. And, you know, he's one of those guys that I can have higher level conversations with when it comes to stuff in the motorcycle scene. And we got some mics, got a podcast started, and
yeah, we'll get into that.
Yeah, we're definitely not as far as you are in episode range, but we're slowly getting there, and it's been fun.
Yeah. Trevor, your turn.
All right. My name is Trevor Schoonover. I've been a gearhead, like anything mechanical, anything with wheels, for pretty much the time I've been alive. Rode dirt bikes as a kid, tore my ankle up. Parents said that's enough of that. And pretty much as soon as I graduated college, got my first real job, got my own health insurance, one of the first things I did was go buy a bike.
Of course.
So I went and bought a 1995 Yamaha TW200, you know, got accustomed to street and trail, and then went and bought a Kawasaki 250. And then a few days after that, I was just out poking around on my own, passed a group of guys that were at the local Hardee's when I lived in Fairmont. James and I used to live maybe 10 minutes from each other. And I was supposed to go meet my wife for coffee. She was in her car.
Oh, boy.
And I was going to catch up with her, and we were going to have coffee. And I swung into Hardee's, started talking to those guys about trails. They said, we're riding over at Canaan if you guys want to join. And, you know, called my then-girlfriend, now wife, and told her, like, hey, here's what I got going on. Is it okay if I just, you know, bail out and go with these guys? And James was among them. So that was my first exposure to the FDSR group and riding with James. And it's been, you know, it's been a great ride so far. So that probably would have been about 2019, yeah. I think that would have been.
You can say it's all been downhill from there, buddy. I don't get it.
Yeah. Like, my bike and my body were in a lot better shape before we ever met each other.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, beating yourself up out there, right? It happens.
Yeah.
So yep. Listen, so Tall Boys and Trackmasters, what's with the, what's, explain the name first of all, and how did the idea for the podcast first come together? It's like, when was that moment when you guys said, you know, we should record this? So how would you describe your show and all that? Just get into it. Let's hear it.
So I would say, you know, going back to what I said there earlier about, you know, Trevor's always been that guy that I could have different type of conversations with. We kind of, I wouldn't say that we kicked around the idea of a show, but we kind of discussed some different shows that we've been watching and seeing. And I remember the name of the podcast came about as, you know, I was kind of talking about maybe getting back into doing some racing, and we just going back and forth a little bit, was talking about what kind of sponsors would you try to seek out right now. And I was like, well, you know, we like Kenda Trackmaster tires and then Tall Boy beer. So if I was up on a stage after a winning race, I would say that my only sponsors were Tall Boys and Trackmasters. And that kind of became a running gag between the two of us for a good while. And then as he kind of said before, we're part of a awesome dual sport group here in the North Central West Virginia called Fairmont Dual Sport Riders. And really the podcast started out as just a way for me and him to kick the wintertime blues and talk about dual sport and adventure bikes just for the Fairmont Dual Sport Rider group. So I'd say like the first 10 or 15 episodes kind of was just specifically for that audience. And then, you know, just kind of grew from there. We decided to start doing some interviews with some different people that we knew, and hearing a lot of people's really cool, interesting backgrounds and stories that you otherwise wouldn't hear in that kind of space. And, you know, just one thing led to another, and it's turned into a full-time production almost at this point.
Now, you guys do, is it your show weekly?
It typically it's every 2 weeks. Okay. We go, and it's live too. So there's no editing. There's no, you know, there's some pre-planning, but you know, a lot of times we call the show Tall Boys and Technical Difficulties just because of that world of being live.
You have to tell me. Yeah. I know that. Now, yeah. Did you guys have any expectations about launching the show and what you thought was going to happen? And like, were your biggest challenges for a show of your type, dual sport, that you're coming across today?
Well, as far as expectations, I went into it, like James was talking about, this is just a way to kind of stay in touch with the guys from the riding group over winter. You know, that's pretty much what I went into it thinking, that I didn't dream that we were going to get to a point that we started interviewing, you know, all the interesting people that we've got to interview here in a couple weeks. Annually, we do a on-site podcast for the West Virginia Adventure Travel Day down in the Capitol. So that's always exciting. But I didn't go into it with a lot of expectations in general, because normally the fewer expectations you have, the more fun you can have with what you're doing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I would agree with him. I think that's the main component of it, is still fun. It doesn't feel like a job. Like there's this entire space is ever changing. There's so much news in the industry and different bike brands. And like you said, you know, opportunities to go and do some really cool things in this space. And at least here in the state of West Virginia, you know, this demographic of adventure and dual sport riding really isn't talked about in a podcast format like we have. So, right. I think that was one of the main attractions for us for starting this, was, you know, get that word out there. And, you know, it's been fun. We've, like you said, we've got to do a lot of really cool different things, such as the Adventure Travel Day thing. I got to go to AIM Expo in Las Vegas last year and cover some stuff live there, which was really cool. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just the topics, the people, just keeps it interesting, keeps it fun, and keeps us coming back and doing it.
Yeah. So would you say that's like the most rewarding part of doing your show? Is those opportunities?
I would say that, and trying to get our voice out there and be heard from our, you know, our aspect and our ideas of what we think is important in this space. I don't know if anybody really even cares, but, you know, we care. And I really think the feedback that we've gotten so far kind of shows that other people care as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like We've overheard guys from the AMA talking about our podcast.
Really?
See, so
that's a feather in your cap. Yeah,
that was exciting. But a big thing is, you know, our hobby being really dirt oriented is we rely heavily on public land staying public.
Yes.
So what this podcast has helped to do is to form more of a cohesive community around like land usage, keeping roads open, and James can talk more to the side of, you know, keeping public roads and things like that open. But, you know, we have had some successes, especially recently, you know, as a whole.
Right. Wow. Now, how much of your show is spontaneous? Is any of your show scripted, or is it really just free flow conversation?
I would say that depends. You know, the interview episodes that we do are kind of scripted to a point. Like we have a certain set of topics that we obviously want to talk to the person about. We have a little segment that we do called the six pack, and it's a quick six questions that we ask every single guest that we have on. So no matter where you're at in your life, you know, what organization you represent, what company you work for, it really does just get down to the nitty-gritty of things like, what's your favorite trail snack? You know, if you could do two mods to a bike, what would they be? Just some different cool things to talk about that I think everyone can relate to, no matter where you are in that in the sport. But yeah, it's as far as everything else goes, it's almost like we'll see something cool in on an industry news standpoint. Like the struggles at KTM. Like, me and Trevor can sit down and talk about that for a long time. So yeah, I'd say the interview part of it is scripted to a point, but really it's the rest of it's just let the mics fly and let's see what happens.
It's like, here's what we're going to talk about today and just let it rip, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Now,
that's awesome because that works great. Now, while you guys are, you're doing the dual sport thing. Did you anticipate difficulty with that topic?
It's kind of, yeah, I don't know. What do you think, Trevor? I'd say we've kicked the can a lot. Sometimes we
scrape the barrel a few times.
Yeah, we've had to do that a time or two, just because, I mean, I'm sure you know as well as anybody else, you can only talk about riding so much until there's just nothing really else to talk about unless something crazy big happens in the sport. But I think that's why I really appreciate the interview side of things as well. That kind of opens up a different world, and you know, but we do like the technical side of dual sport and adventure riding. You know, we can break down stuff to a point where people will probably stop listening if we keep going. So,
yeah, this is probably my favorite format is episodes that relate to tech, be it like suspension, tires, engine mods, etc. Like James said, to the extent that it probably bores people, it's probably like, why would you read into it that much? I just get on my bike and ride. You know what I mean?
Well, you know what it is. It's like when you got that, it becomes an obsession. As we had said earlier, motorcycling becomes an obsession, and then you get a little OCD about things, and you're gonna dig in. But that's the nature of the beast, as they say. So, but getting into to the aspect of motorcycling that you guys are into now, how does that translate with the current state of motorcycling culture right now?
I would say, just from what we've seen, at least in Appalachia here where we're from, is you're starting to see a lot of these people that maybe they grew up racing and riding, you know, exclusively every weekend, to seeing that being on a dual sport adventure motorcycle is one of the most limitless forms of motorcycle transportation. You know, if you like to ride the trails, you can ride all the trails you want. You're street legal to leave from your house and get to that area and ride. If you're a guy that just wants to do occasional dirt roads and gravel roads and then travel all across the entire United States in comfort, you can do that on a big dual sport or adventure bike as well. So at least on our segment, I think it is one of the most freeing segments that you have in motorcycling. And just depending on where you're at in the country, you can ride year round as well.
Yeah, and that's something that I've probably said in one of the first few episodes is you hear about like road and street guys talking about, you know, the freedom of the open road. You haven't experienced freedom until you don't need roads anymore.
Yeah.
Like in this, totally in our state, there's just a huge amount of very unimproved, borderline abandoned side roads, things of that nature. A lot of really cool sights to see that, you know, I came from the Jeep side of things. James spent a lot of time with Jeeps and other off-road builds. Mm-hmm. And on a dual sport, for me, it was even more fun because what would take you 3 hours to cover to get to a certain location in a Jeep, for instance, it's like 30 minutes on a bike. It's a lot more fun.
Yeah.
It really just opened more windows for me to be able to go see more of the state that I grew up in and still live in.
Wow. Is your podcast translating well for the ADV guys?
Yeah, for sure. You know, we're definitely on the more hardcore side of dual sport riding, just personally, what we like to do event-wise and ride-wise. But, you know, I bought a Honda Africa Twin a year and a half ago, and I've kind of really exposed myself to that adventure side of things as well. And I really do see the appeal in it. And I would say at least half of our viewers are adventure riders too. So, I think we tend to not try to, you know, flip on one side of the coin, so to speak. We try to cover everything.
Yeah.
And I think that may go back into the scraping the bottom of the barrel sometimes or running out of content a little bit. So.
That's all right. It happens. Let's talk about the motorcycling in general. What right now is going on in the motorcycle world that excites you, and what trends worry you?
I think me and Trevor, you know, we've discussed this a bunch on the show, but some of the stuff that worries us, I think, is just the approaching unaffordability of motorcycling to absolutely. New people.
from both a standpoint of new bikes and used bikes.
It's
ever since COVID and everything happened, the price of used bikes over doubled. And I really don't know how to tell people your 30-year-old XR650L with 15,000 miles isn't worth, you know, $500 under what you can buy one for new.
Well, so, is it just that there's such a massive surplus of bikes available?
Yeah, that I think that's part of it. You know, it seems at least on the dual sport world, it's a lot of ex-racers or people that ride, and that's not their only machine. You know, they still have a dirt bike that they like to enjoy, but they want a street trail bike. But yeah, you do see that a lot. You'll see a guy come and he'll buy a BMW, you know, 1300 GS, and he's way out of his element. It's too big of a machine, and he crashes it, and he's done with it. And that story gets told over and over and over again through Facebook Marketplace or Craigslist. You see all these machines out there that are just flooding the market. That's definitely a problem.
That's how I got my Kawasaki. Was it had 600 miles on it, which is
really
just about break in for
that,
and paid several grand under what one would go for new, and that was in 2018. Reason being is, you know, it had been laid down on the right hand side, throttle tube was cracked when I went to replace the grips, has a little bit broke up plastics and a dent in the muffler. So that was a case of, somebody wiping out early into their journey into riding or whatever, and then selling the bike. But James and I talk pretty often about, like, this hobby is kind of aging out. So I'm 30, James older than me. I think the youngest guy that we typically ride with is Arthur, right, James, who's probably 23 now. But like, anytime we get around young new riders that we can encourage and try to keep them in this, you try to pass down that knowledge, be it like riding skill, technical knowledge for bike maintenance, repairs, etc. But there is starting to be an unaffordability crisis, but you know, in the last 2 years, I think Honda and Kawasaki have done a good job of releasing pretty budget-friendly models that you can still get out and really enjoy yourself on.
I mean, you see a lot of guys saying, you know what, I screw the used market. I just want to go get a new bike, and it's my bike, and I'll work on it. I don't want anybody else's problems.
I understand that entirely, because every time you buy a used bike, it is a risk.
Oh yeah.
You know, guys talk about, well, it's only got X miles on it, or it's only got X hours on it. I could total a bike out in an hour. If you give me a puddle that's deep enough, I can total a bike out. You can ask James about that one.
Yeah, his nickname is Aquaman for a reason.
Yeah. And I earned the nickname Aquaman probably several occasions, and almost earned it at Red River last year too. But I definitely understand the allure of buying a new bike over used. But now, like, the KTM has switched hands, and they're going to begin predominantly India-based production.
Oh, really?
It's a question of what are you getting for the amount of money that you're paying.
Right.
So,
Where was KTM manufactured previously?
Austria, typically.
Yeah, okay.
Austria.
All right. Wow.
They did have some models, like ADVs, that the engines were produced in China. It was like a shared platform with CFMoto. Okay. Correct me if I'm wrong, James.
Yeah, you're right.
But since the Indian stakeholders now own like the predominant share in the company, you're going to see a lot of manufacturing move from Austria to India. Stuff's going to be built probably to more of a price point. I might be wrong. I'd like to be wrong, but you know.
Yeah, because I know, in the street bike market, the cruiser market, there is a surplus, but that doesn't mean the prices are low. Absolutely not, you know, and I guess for the ADV and the dual sport market, I think it's kind of a niche market, actually. So maybe that's what's keeping the prices up there.
So ADV specifically is one of the only motorcycle markets that's continued to grow over like the last 5 years. But then dual sport is its own subset away from that.
Yeah.
ADV guy, typically, you know, it's a bike that you can crush highway miles on relatively comfortably, mm-hmm. and then take on, you know, gravel roads, fire roads, etc. And then dual sport, and mine and James' opinion, is more to the enduro side of things, like harder trail, going where there's not really roads, gravel, etc. But yeah, everybody that's been involved in the street and road scene knows about Harley's woes of trying to appeal to younger buyers.
Yeah.
And I still don't think they have the formula figured out yet.
Well, formula is eventually everyone gets to that age where they're going to want a cruiser.
Sure.
That's the formula. You know,
yeah, I get that.
Everybody's going to age out and say, like, you know what? I need something a little calmer. So they're going to want to get a cruiser, and they're naturally going to gravitate towards Harley. It's just it's just the way it is. That's the plan.
And then, you know, younger people have less disposable income.
Yeah.
As time goes on, so I bought a house in 2025, and I weep at my mortgage rate compared to people that bought a couple years earlier. That results in less disposable income.
Yeah.
And then in general, most of the younger folks I've talked to are more interested in the, I guess, go fast side of the street. Not that a Harley can't go fast.
No, I'm saying, I totally get it.
Yeah, but they're more interested in like the flashy street bikes, you know.
That's of course, that's now.
All that stuff.
Yeah, that's which now. That, give them a few more years and then they'll say, gotta slow down.
I've seen that. That's a tale as old as time. As you're a brave rider up until your first close call, and then it hits like I'm mortal, you know?
Yeah.
Why is that Hayabusa so cheap?
And then they start thinking ADV, and they start thinking dual sport, and then eventually they start thinking, they start thinking bagger. So that's just the way, that's the nature of the beast. That's the way it goes.
Which you can practically have a bagger ADV bike. You just have to put a set of panniers on it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, you know, and don't limit yourself. You know, any form of motorcycling is awesome in my opinion. And there is no do it all unicorn, you know, cruiser bagger. There is no unicorn do it all dual sport or adventure bike. You know, you have to cover your bases. At least in our world, what we've seen is typically a guy will have a dedicated dual sport bike and a dedicated ADV bike. You know, I've got a Gas 700 that is not great at anything, but it's good at everything on the dual sport side of things. And then I've got the Africa Twin that's, you know, I take it on single track and stuff because I'm an idiot, but it's one of the best at ADV bikes ever made. So
I watched him pay for taking that big Africa Twin on trails.
Well, let me ask you that. Are either of you guys mountain bikers?
No, I'm not. No.
Really? That surprises me.
A lot of our buddies are, though, that do this dual sport and racing thing.
Brian Holmes comes to mind immediately. Yeah. He's a mountain biker.
They usually, mountain bikers, because I am one, usually have a little more of that, let's see what happens if I do this. In them, you know, and so there's a different fear level.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, that's interesting. As far as
we're lazy, Ted, we like to not pedal our machines. We want to throttle and make it go.
Yeah. It's a little easier to do this than you just, okay. I get it. Yeah. I totally get it.
my wife and I, when we went on our honeymoon, we did rent some, mountain bikes and, I enjoyed it. Like that's something that I would be interested in getting into. But as it stands, that's another hobby that I have to research as to like what bike do I want, what equipment do I want, and that's another thing.
It's another like, expensive hobby.
Well, I need to do maintenance on X, Y, and Z. I need to do wheel bearings on mountain bike on top of other bikes.
No, you don't.
I totally get that. And seeing like I see used mountain bikes pop up for sale like locally or
for the
on
same
classifieds
reason
or whatever.
You see bikes pop up on Marketplace because guys get into it and then they have one crash and they say, I can't do this anymore.
I'm totally out of my element on the mountain bike side of things, but just looking at a bicycle and they're wanting $6,000 for I just can't wrap my head around that.
But I'll tell you, if you want really improve your off-road handling skills, go mountain biking.
Yep.
Yeah, that'll do it for you. As far as it goes, because you guys have a lot of interactions with all types of bikers and even non-bikers. So what's the biggest misconception you get across from non-riders that they have about motorcycling and even ADV or dual sport riding?
I mean, we're not a group of uneducated reprobates, right?
That's funny.
So I hold 2 degrees in engineering. We regularly ride with people that have, you know, pretty diverse professional backgrounds, including like optometry and, you know, pretty much you name it. I think especially on the dirt side of things, that dirt riders are seen as like hooligans typically, because especially in rural areas, you've got like, you know, teenagers on unplated, unregistered dirt bikes running on pavement and causing a mess and whatever. But, you know, the folks that are out there trying to do it legally are, you know, don't fall into the category of hooligan. We're not out there to tear up private land like a lot of people see it as. We don't hate the environment. Like, that's a thing that's especially seems to be prevalent in our state, is we've got like some natural resource oriented clubs that are really overzealous about, we are going to bar everybody but like hikers from being able to use, you know,
I've come across that
X tract of land. And you know, that goes back into the land rights thing I was talking about earlier. And it's just kind of a, I don't know if I want to call it a battle necessarily, but it's a struggle.
Yeah, I agree. James, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, I would definitely agree with Trevor on the land usage side of things there. And we've talked about that at length, but yeah, I would say that there's also an astigmatism, if you want to call it that, of you look at this guy on a big ADV bike and you're like, why don't you just buy a cruiser or, you know, something more comfortable for the highway? And I think that you look at that, it's easy to say, oh, you know, the BMW guy's the dude that just goes to Starbucks and goes back to his lawyer job and talks how hardcore he was this weekend riding those gravel roads and stuff. But yeah, like, you just have such a diverse group of awesome people in this segment. And like Trevor was saying, you never know who you're going to ride with through the day. Yeah. And I think that's one of my favorite parts of this sport, is it is literally all walks of life. You know, you've got the guy that's working a minimum wage job, barely scraping by at the gas station. And then, yeah, literally an optometrist with us, you know. So that's definitely my favorite part of dual sport and ADV. But, yeah, there's definitely some, you know, resubscribed notions about the off-road world that, you know, we're just out there hooligans tearing stuff up like the side-by-side guys do. You know, shout out side-by-side guys. But
they didn't do themselves any favors when it came to earning the reputation.
Yeah, no,
and it's not all of them. Right. You know, it's not to generalize a group, but, you know, the land rights stuff in this state really started to ramp up, or land use stuff in the state really ramped up when side-by-sides became a big thing on the scene.
Yeah,
but yeah, James is talking about, and same thing I said about, you know, the plethora of different backgrounds and stuff, people you meet, and you'll ride with them for a year or more before you ever find out about that, because your identity, like at your job or what have you, kind of disappears once you're all trying to make it through like a section of really hard trail. Because then you're just a bunch of idiots out there all trying to survive the same mess that you got yourselves into. Yeah. So, yeah, this hobby does form really strong bonds and, you know, a brotherhood, so to speak, because you are relying on the people that you're with in the event of mechanical breakdown or injury or something like that to actually get out of the situation you're in.
I thought you were going to say there for a second that, and this is true too, there's times that we've ridden with people for months on end and you don't really even know their name. You just know them that, yeah, that was
the
guy
that bike.
Yeah, you know the bike. That was the dude on the KLR 650 that hit that hill. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I remember him. I don't remember his name or, you know, where he works or how many kids he has. But
for the first several months after I met James, his contact in my phone was just Honda XR650R.
And now here you are doing a podcast together. Imagine that.
Yeah.
Okay. What's the biggest misconception of motorcyclists of each other?
That we're all the same skill level.
Yeah.
There you go.
That's big.
Yeah.
You know, especially on dirt, is that you just assume that the people that you're with are equal to or greater than your skill level. And then, like, nobody wants to be the guy that accidentally got a beginner in over their head. Because then once nobody's having fun, then what was the point of going out and riding? And that's not to speak to, like, a challenging portion of trail. I think that overcoming challenge is a big part of this hobby. It's a big reward. But there's been a couple occasions where you just kind of feel bad for the situation that everybody ended up in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say.
There's, of course, you got your ADV guys and you got your dual sport guys and you got your cruiser dudes and then you got your street bike, you know, crotch rocket guys. I mean, what's that misconception between all of them? I'm like, what do you, I guess it's the stereotypes, right?
Yeah.
Does that exist among your groups?
Yeah. Kind of what I was saying about the big BMW guys, like, you know, that's a total bias right there that, these guys, they just get out and they'll ride at the nearest Starbucks and then they're going to go back and talk about how hardcore they are. Dude, that notion was in both of our heads for a long time. And we met a gentleman here in our town, Fairmont, Mr. Dave Porter, who rides.
Yes, shout out to Dave.
Yeah, dude rides a BMW 1250 GS, and he is an absolute animal in that thing and put many people to shame that we ride with.
Yeah.
So,
and then even on the same token as that, you've got that, and you've got the guy that shows up on a KTM 500 EXC 6 days edition that's completely kitted out, and he's got, you know, all the gear that match, just the most expensive climb stuff that you can buy. And you're like, all right, this dude's serious. And he gets out there and falls down the first turn that you go around.
Yeah,
so
yeah, we've seen it
all over
we've
the place.
Seen it from both ways. Like, I've been shamed horrifically by guys on 40-year-old bikes with, like, horrible suspension. You can hear the bike bog because the carburetor's, you know, dirty or not tuned right. And they're riding, like, hiking shoes or walker boots. And I watch them go up stuff that I just sit at the bottom of, and I think there's no way I'm even attempting it. And then on the other side of the coin, like James said, is guys that show up with really high dollar, all matching gear, you know, a bike that has every mod that you can imagine done to it, and then they get out there and flounder. But, Jane, I want to go ahead and mention this. James talked about Dave Porter. I've never seen anybody have so little sympathy for a piece of equipment as Dave. So the BMW that he has a telelever front suspension, and the top of it mounts to a welded boss that's attached to the frame of the bike. He came riding into camp, and his handlebars were cocked like 20 degrees from left to right. And we thought he just bent his bars. No, he broke the welded boss off of that portion of the frame on that bike, proceeded to ride it all the way back to our little base camp where we put a rod on, and then rode it home after that.
Damn.
So
that's hardcore.
He definitely whooped on that big bike, and he did a lot to make GS guys look cooler.
Have either one of you guys done any BDRs?
Yes, I've done the MA BDR, and I have done the BDRX up in Pennsylvania as well.
Oh, really? Wow.
I haven't done any, have intentions to. I do like to get out moto camp.
Oh yeah.
But haven't been out to do a BDR yet.
Wow. So did you like the MA BDR?
Let me just put it to you this way. I understand, like, the way that they routed the MA BDR and the way that they set it up, and who that demographic is for, which is for the average adventurer dual sport rider. So in that respect, they did a fantastic job.
Right.
Now, I am not the average dual sport or adventure rider. I am a masochist. I want to be absolutely punished and exhausted when I'm done riding any kind of trail.
Of course.
But you know, all things considered, yes, they did a good job on that for that side of things. I know of multiple roads that come off of the MABDR that would be more tailored to people of my caliber and Trevor's and the stuff that we like to ride. So, yeah, I mean, it was fun. The PA Wilds was good.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's also a terrain issue. You know, here on the East Coast, we just don't have as much cool land to ride as what they do out west. So it's it's hard to find those roads in our area in Appalachia. And, you know, even with the land usage issues we have, there's a lot of cool roads that are gated off that you're not going to be able to get back into anymore. So, yeah, I would love to do a lot more BDR stuff, especially out west. I think like Idaho and, you know, Washington, California, Nevada, that stuff would really, you know, tickle my fancy.
Yeah. And I know, I'm sure you guys have seen the Southeast BDR and the Northeast BDR.
Yep.
I mean, as far as it goes for those kind of rides, do you think that those would be more suitable for your kind of riding? You know, East Coast riding, as we know, as you know, East Coast riding's like you said, is very different from Midwest and West Coast riding. You know, we have a lot of roots, we have a lot of mud, we have a lot of sand. We have all those things that you don't necessarily get out there. But is it better?
I think it has the potential to make you a better rider, dealing with the sloppy roots and nasty stuff that we have here on the East Coast. I would say that you can kind of look at the track record of like the Grand National Cross Country Series and, you know, National Hare and Hound and big time race series. And majority of the time, it's a guy from the East Coast over here in this area that's dominating that stuff. So,
yeah, I don't know that I've ever heard of an East Coast enduro rider going out to the West Coast and saying, man, I really struggled. I was, you know.
All this traction is
really
terrible.
Yeah. And that's not to say that there's not hard terrain out there, right? You got a lot of really heavy sand,
a lot of rock,
really unforgiving rock, but it's typically dry. That's something that we really deal with in this state, is trying to ride during the rainy seasons. A lot of clay, a lot of roots, a lot of rocks, creek beds. You see it in the Jeep community too, and off-road community is, you know, guys that come out west to come do East Coast stuff, it's a different ball game.
Oh yeah. Oh, definitely.
It's like, what do you mean you have to try to miss trees?
Yeah, what are the things growing out of the ground?
I mean, we just drive right over a cactus out west.
I remember of course, East Coast mountain biking is one thing. I remember the first time and even the second time I went out to Utah to Moab to do some riding out there. And it, what a different animal that is out there. It's like, yeah, look at all this traction I have. Yeah. Look.
I wouldn't know what to do with traction.
It's like, yeah, where you're struggling here in the East Coast, either you're not out there so much. Yeah. That's not, like you said, it's not to say that there aren't difficult parts, but there are. So let's get back to your podcast just a little bit. You guys do your show entirely on YouTube.
Well, yes, it started out that way anyway, but it does. The majority of our stuff is on YouTube. Yes. It also broadcasts live to our Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
And we recently just started putting some of the stuff on Spotify, since Spotify allows for video podcast things now.
Wow.
So I think that was the biggest thing for us, was, you know, our podcast being a video style podcast. I didn't feel like the audio only would translate just because of things that you can see us doing,
of course,
or we're talking about. Some of the segments that we have, you know, we have different overlays that actually show video or photos or pictures as we're talking. So Spotify, we didn't really do a whole lot. But, yeah, the last two episodes of the show we actually did put out on Spotify, and we'll continue to do that.
So how do you approach the visual side of it versus if it's just where podcasts are traditionally audio only? You guys have to have a whole different production method now that you're doing it on YouTube.
Yeah, it's I think our streaming service StreamYard really does tailor our show to be able to do those type of things. Having the video files to be able to be played while we're talking, and that sort of thing. I just think that I'm a visual learner. I think that Trevor's probably in that same boat as well. So our guys typically have a short attention span, I think, sometimes our majority audience. So if they can see us talking, see us putting things on the screen to, you know, when we're doing research or interviews and anything of that sort, that it kind of tailors more to our audience.
Right. How is your audience? How do I explain this? Okay, so with an audio only podcast, you have you have basically subscribers and downloads. Is that the same for you guys as just doing it on YouTube?
We typically get, I have a YouTube channel that's separate from what we do on the podcast, and it's mainly for our dual sport riding videos and stuff that we do or go to different events, but it actually posts onto that same channel. But I actually saw an increase in subscriptions to my personal channel just based on the podcast thing. So I would say that
that helped
the YouTube algorithm and channel there a little bit. But,
sure.
Typically I would say we tend to get about 1,000 views per episode, give or take, within 4 or 5 days of it being released. But we typically have a dedicated following of, I'd say, 35, 40 to 50 people that they're going to watch every episode regardless of what comes up. But you also do have, one of the things I like about the interview segment is you have people that know the people that are going to be coming on the show, and they want to sit down and listen to this person or their friends or family. And then they typically like what they see, and then they'll follow, subscribe, and then you get more viewership that way.
And it's cool on a lot of episodes getting viewer comments and stuff like that, because it helps drive conversation. A lot of times people bring up points or something like that hadn't been considered. And, any amount of engagements on our episodes, we really appreciate. So, long story short, we love our regular viewers.
so you get people actually call into your show while you're doing it.
Well, they'll comment. The streaming service that we use has a feature that as soon as anybody comments, and that can be from YouTube, it can be from the Facebook page, wherever they're watching it, it'll actually pop up right on screen and we can read it.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it makes it, like Trevor said, there's a lot of times that maybe there's a topic we're talking a little bit about and there's more to the story and this person knows, and that kind of drives the conversation.
I mean, do you see a lot of negative interaction at all?
Not
particularly.
Good.
Jinx.
Good.
Yeah. you do have those out there. I would say that, at least on the podcast side of things, we typically try to be like our dual sport events that we put on, is if 70% of the people enjoyed the product, you're doing what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah. Any chance of you guys making at least the audio version of your podcast available on iTunes and things like that?
Yeah, I think with us doing the Spotify thing now that they offer the video side, there's ways that I could edit that to make it where it would be more friendly for the audio, viewership only. But there's room for that in the future for sure.
Cool beans. You guys don't have a website, do you?
No, I think that's probably the next step in us growing the brand, so to say. We'd like to do that. Typically our stuff is put out on the Facebook page. We don't just do, show stuff on there. We like to share some funny memes once in a while, or some news articles that we find worthy that we're probably going to talk about on the show. We'll share that on there and
share a lot of info for the Dakar rally every year that happens.
Dakar,
unfortunately the bike side of that rally doesn't get near the notoriety or exposure that the vehicle side does.
The last 2 years too. It really is. The last 2 years, we've done a segment we call Dakar So Far, and we'll break down every single stage of, Rally 1, Rally 2, original by Motoil, which was the Molly Moto class that got renamed a few years ago. But, me running the 24 Hours of Appalachia series, which is one of the only East Coast rally series that there is for motorcycles at this point.
Oh, nice.
Kind of opened my eyes to that world a few years ago, and I think that competing in a rally like that is the highest echelon of dual sport or adventure riding racing.
Oh, absolutely.
Call it that. So,
I've watched some of the Dakar in years past, and it's grueling. It is a grueling event. Charlie Borman had done that as well, broke both of his hands. And I've interviewed numerous people who've done the rally. It's just a really an amazing event.
Yeah. Well, and this past year was no different. Mm-hmm. You know, Daniel Chucky Sanders from Australia kind of seemed like he was going to run away with it and get two consecutive Dakar wins in a row, and has a really bad crash and breaks his collarbone, and KTM looks like they're kind of out of the running, and Monster Energy Honda is an absolute giant. They have most of the top riders that you can possibly have in Dakar, and it looked like Ricky Brabec was going to run away with the lead there and ends up losing by 2 seconds. So that was very heartbreaking for him.
Wow,
but,
you know, you're not great, kidding. Man,
great
man.
Action for us.
Wow.
Yeah. One of Honda's rally competitors, Skylar Howell, was previously raced for Husqvarna. And abruptly, Husky ended their with him, and he got picked up by Honda. Hmm. And does pretty well. I like that guy.
Mr. Mustache.
Yeah. I like anybody that gets out there and does it. You know, that's probably the most brutal race. I would say more brutal than the Baja 1000, for instance. And it's cool that something like that still exists. You know, on the four-wheel drive side of things, James and I really like the Land Rover Camel Trophy that was, prevalent back through the late 80s, mm-hmm. mid 90s or something like that. And that spirit of adventure and going off in the unknown against all odds is pretty cool.
That's awesome. Hell yeah. So what's next for your podcast?
Getting so popular that we have subscription services. We can both quit our day jobs and just talk about motorcycles all day long. That's the next step.
That's the next step.
Yep.
You got anything cool coming up that we should know about?
Episode number 100.
Yeah, that's coming up now.
Yeah, 100. We're gonna break 100.
Now, I recall on a recent show that we were all on together.
Yes.
You guys mentioned something about excessive amounts of beverages that
yes,
may be taking place there.
PBR, Pabst Blue Ribbon, for the last couple of years had a 99 count can box, and we are unfortunately not one of the states that you can get that in. So my wife and I looked around. The closest you can get one is a distributor ship up in PA.
Right.
Like a ways up in the PA. So that's probably not going to happen, but it was going to, episode 100 was going to be tall boys and alcohol poisoning.
Yeah. Our final show.
Yeah. That was going to be it.
We just die and you never hear from us again.
Oh, go on a good note.
Hey, look, 100 is like it's I guess you guys could consider it. That's a pretty big event for you guys.
That's a huge milestone for us. When James and I first started this, like I said, I didn't go into it with really expectations, and it's naturally exceeded, you know, what I thought we'd do with it. So to be at episode 100 coming up is really, really cool. It's been a great experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Especially with something that has had no backing of, like, you know, other, I don't know how to say it. Like, we've been featured on other people's podcasts and things of that nature. But, you know, we haven't been propped up necessarily by a writing team or any form of management. And I'm sure it shows, you know, in the quality of the content sometimes. Because a lot of times for tech episodes, I'm frantically sending James bullet points on my lunch break. But it's been cool to have a truly grassroots podcast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You're having fun, and that's all that matters.
Yeah.
How can people learn more about you guys?
Definitely look up the Facebook page, Tall Boys and Trackmasters. Give us a follow on there. Like we said, we put up all kinds of different things, not just the episodes, but they are there as well. You can look at our YouTube channel, which is under Right Cycle Works, and follow us on there. And like I said before, we are on Spotify. We have two episodes on there as well. So Tall Boys and Trackmasters on Spotify.
All right. Any closing words you'd like to share about your dual sport riding, motorcycling in general, or anything else?
I would say that if you are on the fence about giving dual sport or ADV a try, do it, man. You're not going to regret it. I was one of those guys for many years that just thought that was going to be boring, especially coming from the racing side of things. I was like, that's what old slow fat people do when they can't hack it on the racetrack anymore. They don't want to do that. So, but I've said this before on our show that swinging a leg over an XR 650L and heading out with some of my dad's friends and him. What I saw more of my state of West Virginia in the first 2 or 3 hours than I had my entire 30 years of being alive. So just being able to get out and just that true rebellious freedom of being on a motorcycle is, at least in my opinion, exacerbated tenfold when you can get in the woods and do that and no one's telling you where to go.
Awesome. How about you, Drew?
Yeah, I agree with James' sentiment, especially, you know, if you're thinking about doing it, do it. And it really doesn't matter what bike you start on. You know, we've said for many, many episodes ago that the best bike to get out and start your adventure is the one you got. Mm-hmm. Whatever it might be, you know, it's extremely enjoyable. I broke both my wrists in 2024, and I'm still excited to go throw a leg over a bike and get back out there.
I'm detecting a trend with you.
There's nothing like it. I'm not the most accident prone rider, but I've had some bad luck here and there. But yeah, it's a great time. One of my favorite hobbies I've ever been involved in.
Awesome. All right, guys, listen, I want to thank you very much for being on the show. You've been absolutely wonderful. Don't go anywhere. I want to talk to you when we're done, but thanks for being on the show. I greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, we appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely, Ted. Appreciate it. And looking forward to maybe we can get to 400 or 500 episodes like you have as well.
Hopefully. That's hard. I'm sure you will. All right, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you in a minute. Bye-bye. All right, that's going to wrap it up for this episode of the Motorcycle Men Podcast. A huge thanks to James and Trevor of the Tall Boys and Trackmasters Podcast for hanging out with us and giving us a peek into the world of dual sport riding and their take on podcasting. If you haven't already, check out their YouTube channel and to see their full range of work, and there'll be links in the show notes, of course. Special thanks to our sponsors, Tobacco Motorwear, Scorpion Helmets, Wild Ass Seats, and Viking Bags for supporting the show and providing the motorcycle community with great gear. As always, ride safe, take the long way home, and remember, here at the Motorcycle Men Podcast, we say stupid crap so you don't have to. We'll catch you on the next ride.